It's episode 9 of the Improv Comedy Connection, and I am your host, Whit Schiller. We're taking another different angle in this particular episode, which features Bone Hampton. Bone is a veteran stand-up comedian who's also had a number of roles in various movies and television series. You might have seen him recently in the America's Got Talent competition, which inexplicably I didn't even ask him about. But that's okay, because we ended up exploring how he approaches his craft, and there are a lot of interesting things to draw from what Bone shares that can be applicable to not only stand-up, but improv, acting, and communication generally. So here is the Bone Hampton episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. This is Bone Hampton on the Improv Comedy Connection. It's good to be with you again, Bone.
Hey, man, it's always good to be with you, man. It's a good day. It's a good day when I'm with you.
Well, we first met, I think, in like 2007, 2008 at a music festival. And I had seen a little bit of your material, I think on TV or whatever, but we got a chance to kind of spend time, and I've always appreciated not only what you do, but who you are. So this is really fun to get a chance to talk with you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. So that's cool. For folks who don't know you, unlike a lot of the guests that we've had, or I think maybe even all the guests before today, people have had some heavy involvement in improv, but you've been heavily involved in stand-up and some acting. That's been your focus, right?
Absolutely. My foundation is all in stand-up. And I slipped into the acting world from living in L.A. You know, if you live in L.A. and you're a stand-up, you know, the primary focus is to let your stand-up slip you off into the acting comedic world.
Yeah.
And that's where I had begun to slip off into. And the only thing I know about improv is fish sticks. That's all I know.
it's a little bigger world than that. But
that's all I know. You talk to me about improv, all I say is fish sticks. Yeah. Oh, you don't know fish sticks? You don't know improv. So it's always, you know, and I'm the kind of guy, even when I was playing college football, I become a fan of somebody that can do something that I can't do. And it's really very intriguing to me to watch somebody do something I can't do. And people in the world of improv is just amazing to me, because in my world of stand-up, I think about something that's funny. I see if it makes strangers laugh.
Yeah.
And if I can do it 3 times and they laugh at it, then I can do it 30 times. And if I can do it 30 times, then it's part of my hour.
Right.
And so that's stand-up.
Yeah, and it's a completely different world. But before we get into the distinctions and kind of how you approach it, you grew up in Texas, and that's where you started doing comedy.
Grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, which, you know, we call it a big city, but it really ain't. It's a suburb of Dallas, but as far as we're concerned, it's our own city. We got our own county, so we got our own city.
It's a way different city than Dallas.
Oh, it's so different. But I quickly learned, whenever I get out of Texas and I tell somebody I'm from Fort Worth, they give me the side eye, and I'm be like, Dallas, okay? It's Dallas. They're like, oh, okay. And so I started in Fort Worth. After I graduated from college, I went, Steve Harvey used to have a club in Dallas.
Okay.
And so I started going to the open mic over there. And yeah, man, it was, wow. It was a whole new world for me.
Was this after college or before college?
This was after college.
Okay.
Now, while I was in college, they filmed the movie Necessary Roughness on our campus, and I had a small part in that.
Okay.
And that's where I met Sinbad.
Okay. And did he encourage you in comedy? Is that?
So Necessary Roughness is a college football movie.
Right.
And so in between takes, we were all pretending to be old lady characters, old church lady characters.
Okay.
And Sinbad had a deal with ABC at the time, and he had asked me to come and film one of the episodes. He's like, I'm filming 5. I want you on episode 4. And so we going to do it. And then he called me after episode 2 and said, oh, they canceled it, man. Don't worry about it. But you funny, man. You should do this. And I was like, man, I'm just a little old dude from Fort Worth. I don't understand that kind of rejection. So I had to call a therapist to figure out, now, what just happened with my life? One minute I'm going to be on TV with Sinbad. The next minute I'm up at Walmart talking about, man, y'all still hired? I was just playing. Keep my application in here.
It was pretty jarring for you?
Yeah, because yeah. I was like, man, I won a lottery.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even have to go to L.A. I'm like, at that time, I mean, there really was nobody bigger than Sinbad except Cosby. as far as just like being, you know, that, I mean, you know, yeah, Eddie Murphy, right. But still in the world of stand up, I mean, Eddie Murphy was doing movies.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really like that stand up junkie per se.
Okay.
You know, he had did his movies. I don't even know if he had did Raw at that point when this was happening, but Sinbad was a stand up junkie. I mean, he was the guy that's where he made his living. So it really threw, I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm young. I'm in college. I wasn't prepared for this. Mm-hmm. It was too much of a high to have too much of a low. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to put it together. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, man, just sitting here talking to you right now, I realize that probably helped me in my career to understand, man, don't let them highs get you too high. Mm-hmm. 'Cause the low from it will really hurt you.
Yeah.
And I mean, hurt you in a way that you might can't recover. So I was like, yeah, I'm not finna get too high on these highs.
Yeah. So did you kind of bow out of comedy for a while after that?
No. Okay. I mean, I was still in college, okay. So I hadn't even finished college
yet. Okay.
I just took it as a feather in my cap of like, hey, man, you might ought to really pay attention to this, because that's basically one of the greats that thought you was funny enough to be on his show.
Yeah.
And then a year later, Jamie Foxx came through. And he used to have this ugly girl character on his TV series in Living Color, mm-hmm. called Wanda,
right.
Which I thought was the funniest character ever made. And when he came through, I did the impersonation for him and managed to win the contest at his show in Dallas. And from that, he looked at me like, man, you funny. I'm like, look, this is Sinbad and Jamie Foxx have looked me in my eyes and said, I'm funny. So when I get this college degree, I think I might look at this as a choice.
Yeah, those are two pretty good eyes for comedy at that time.
Right?
Yeah.
It ain't like it's Craig from high school.
Right. I came in third for class clown.
Yeah. It ain't like the dude that was wrapping my ankles. You pretty funny, Bone. I'm like, man, what you know? Will you wrap my ankles tighter, please?
So then what did you do after college to pursue it?
So I started going to Steve Harvey's comedy club that he had in Dallas, and I was going to the open mic, and I made a decision that I will continue with this as long as my career continue to move forward. Okay. As long as I move forward, I stick with it. But if it ever starts going backwards, I go it on and try to find me a job in emergency administration and disaster planning, which is what I got my degree in.
Okay.
And it just kept moving forward. And every comic that would come through, from Michael Collier to Yvette Wilson, who else came through? I would try to get the headliner's ear. Mm-hmm. And just say, hey, I just got one question to ask you. I don't want to take all your time. Can you give me one nugget? Mm-hmm. And the ones that saw what I did, they said, man, you need to move to L.A. And Yvette Wilson, she was from the Moesha show. And she said, you know, Bone, the fact that you are a black male and you're clean and you getting the same laughs as the dirty comics, if you go to L.A. and you can do that in L.A., what you just did here in Dallas, you pretty much can write your own ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely encouraging. And so I started recycling my aluminum cans and saved up my money and moved out to L.A. And then there, you know, it's the big lottery. It's like you just keep going because, you know, you never know who's going to see you one night. And you just keep doing it. And things started changing. 5 minutes turned to 10 minutes, turned to 15 minutes, turned to half an hour. And next thing you know, you're doing movies with Sandra Bullock and Bradley Cooper and sitting at the table with Whoopi Goldberg.
So those opportunities came to you because of people just sort of dropping by and seeing your set?
Yes.
Okay.
I got my first manager. I was in a small room, and it was probably about 12 people in the room, and I was dying a slow death. I mean, but, you know, it's okay. That's what you know in this world of stand-up. It's like, hey, man, just keep pushing through. This is just what it is right now. Yeah. And one lady, I promise you, I felt like she was shooting daggers at me, and I couldn't take it no more. I was like, do I remind you of somebody that owe you money? Why are you looking at me like this? And she looked around and she was like, who, you talking to me? I'm like, yeah. She like, well, I was trying to figure out why I ain't never seen you on TV because I think you so funny, which was a big lesson in like, hey, man, you never know what people are thinking. Stop assuming you know and just go and do your jokes that you wrote before you came to the show.
Yeah.
And turns out she was a manager and she signed me and then she got me in front of other people and things started happening until she eventually, she was like, I'm not making enough money off of anybody, so I'm going to have to let the management company go. But it was so encouraging. I'm like, just keep on doing it. And I started doing it more. Me and Sherry Shepherd became best friends, so I would be at spots that she was at, and they would see me, and they was like, hey, won't you come audition for the movie? Not the movie, her TV show, Less Than Perfect. And then I met Zach Levi, the guy that plays Shazam, and he was like, man, you want to look at this acting a little bit more serious. And I was like, well, most cutest dude in Hollywood, I don't have that on my resume. Most cutest dude in Hollywood. I'm just a fat dude trying to make people laugh with glasses. He was like, man,
there's
come
room
on.
For everyone.
So
there's
he
room
took
for everyone,
to
Bone.
There's room for everybody. I was like, I just can't go down the lane you going down. Okay. I need a different lane for somebody like me. And so a casting director saw me, put me in something, then called an agent and said, hey, you really need to look at this guy because I done casted him pretty much for everything he comes to read. And that agent is the one that got me on My Name is Earl and Medium and All About Steve, the movie with Sandra Bullock and Bradley Cooper. And then, you know, once you kind of got a few things on your resume, it's a lot easier because people know that you have been approved by other big wigs. So you do My Name is Earl. That's an NBC approval. So now Medium comes along because Medium's like, well, you've already been NBC approved. So it's a lot easier to get you on here. And then I do Less Than Perfect and Less Than Perfect. Like, well, you NBC approved and now ABC approved. So when it's time to do The View, they like, well, he's already been approved by the network. So it's easy to throw him on there.
So do you feel that you can you manage that process at all? Or does it just sort of go its own way for your career?
That's a great question. You have to let it organically go the way it's going to go. But as you see the direction it's going, you do have to manage it. Otherwise, it'll be all over the place and you'll just be sitting up trying to figure out like what just happened. And that's where managers and agents actually come into play. And a lot of times as artists, well, first of all, we don't like paying a commission. You know, we paying you money, then we the one on stage that's either going to get a standing ovation or get booed. But that's the reason that you have somebody, because they know, well, if you do A, B, and C, it makes sense for you to do D, E, and F. Whereas a lot of times we'll sit there, well, I did A, B, and C. I should do Z now. It's like, no, you don't go from one line in a TV sitcom to being the main guy in the movie. Like, that's just not what it is. Well, you don't know. Yes, I do know. I know enough to know we need to do a couple of more of these. But you let what happens. You know, there's been stand-up comics that have done stuff that they wasn't ready for. And that's probably the hardest thing is to accept that you may not be ready for something that may be offered to you. And you need to have some people that's like, hey, you're not ready to do this whole thing. It's coming, but just take your time.
Well, and there's so many kind of parallel tracks that comedians take. And you probably see it more clearly with stand-up comedians, but you do see it in improvisers, et cetera, where you'll find them gravitating towards acting roles or other hosting roles or things like that, that are, it's a different skill set. And you got to figure out how to learn that craft alongside.
Because as a stand-up, we don't listen. As a stand-up, we just talking. That's what we doing. I mean, I listen to see if you laugh, but that's not really my driving force. My driving force is the jokes I wrote before I came to this stage. So you are listening to me and I'm driving this conversation, but acting is all about listening. And whenever a director catches you waiting to say your next line, instead of engaging non-verbally with the person that's talking to you, you're going to lose your job. And one time when I was able to, when you guys let me be a part of what y'all do, I was like, I am not good at responding to listening right now, because I had just got through doing minutes of stand-up, and I'm like, I hear y'all, but I don't know how to listen the way I need to listen to y'all. So, yes, coming from the improv world to the acting world, it's you're not switching an entire different gear, whereas stand-ups, we're switching an entire different gear, which is why most of the time they're like, give a stand-up his own show, but don't cast the stand-up as one of the actors to help the show move forward, because they usually don't know how to do it.
I understand what you're saying. I felt like when we did have you join us for a game or a scene or whatever, you do listen better than most stand-up comedians do. And which is maybe a sad commentary on the rest. But I do remember, and I've seen this a number of times with you, and I think you said it happens a lot, where you will end up having the crowd interact with you when you're not necessarily going to the crowd to do crowd work.
Man, I be trying to depend on the crowd being scared of me because I'm 6'2", 240 plus, black man. Ain't y'all scared to say something to me? But apparently, that's just in my mind. I am the most approachable comic, clearly, because always there's a club in Utah called Wise Guys, and they are just like, Bone, we cannot regulate your room because it never fails. You're going to have several people just talk to you. I'm like, they forget I'm doing a show. They feel like we sitting in their living room just having a conversation. And so it's like, it's one of the best things that I got going for me in stand-up is people feel so comfortable and so relaxed that they feel like I'm just one of their family members, one of their friends. But it also, it just happens to me. They don't mind talking to me, yelling at me. And it's never anything mean or hateful. And that's why I can't get mad at them, because if you're heckling me, then I had a right to cut you. I can do whatever. But when you just like, you just want to be a part of it because you like, I like you so much. I just want to say something to you, Bone. And I'm like, I can't hold that against you because it just got the best of you. I've had people raise their hand in the audience before. I'm talking and I'm like, do you have your hand up? And he's like, yeah. I was like, what? You said that you was from Dallas, but then you said you wasn't from Dallas. I'm like, are you serious? Did we just stop this show so I can tell you that Fort Worth is a suburb of Dallas? Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm like, you got to be kidding. You got to be kidding. This did not just happen. And then somebody yells out, it is what it is. I'm like, no, we're not starting that. Y'all not finna just be yelling stuff at me. Muffin don't bite. What is happening right now? And it's just like, okay, I don't know how this happened, but we in it now. And you have to find a good way, a gracious way to shut it down without being a different person than the audience feel like you are right now. Because they really, they like you. That's why they're talking to you. They're not talking to you because they're mad at you or they hate you. They talking to you because they like, man, you just so inviting. So, yes, that is something I do have to deal with.
Is there anything that you do to try to be kind of that sort of approachable on stage? Or are you really trying to do the opposite?
You know, I always believe that stand-up is just a version of who you really are. And so once you start trying to do too much different from who you are, the problem is going to become when something happens and you can't respond in character fast enough, who you are is going to come out. And so I'm just a good time guy. Like, I'll be the first one to tell you I am nowhere near the funniest dudes out there in the world. Like, there are some people, you know how Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, they have a basketball gene in them that everybody else didn't get. They just got this other thing. It's just in them. I believe the same thing with comedy. I believe like Dave Chappelle, Brian Regan, Carlin, Sinbad, like they just got a funny gene that everybody else didn't have. That they just do. And I'll be the first one to point out guys that I think have that. And it's like, nah, they got that extra thing. I started out with a comedian named Cat Williams. And when we were doing open mics, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, I saw it in. I was like, hey, y'all, Cat owns something else. Like, he a different dude than the rest of us. I know we all in the seventh grade playing basketball, but I'm telling you, Cat already know how to dribble. He already know how to dunk in the seventh grade. And so I watched him. I was like, he got a different gene. My gene is I just know how to have a good time. Like, I'm the guy that is like, man, if Bones here, it's going to be a little bit more fun than if he wasn't. Why? I don't know, man. That's just the way he is. He's a fun dude. He ain't never trying to throw no shade on nobody. He always trying to figure out a way to edify the people around him. He's just that fun dude. That's the way I approach the stage in comedy. From the minute I walk out on stage, I want everybody in the room to feel like, man, y'all all my friends. Y'all all got invited here on purpose. Ain't nobody better than the next person. Y'all all my people. And I try to present my act in that way. And when people start talking to me, I kind of feel like I think you succeeded in doing that with people, because you see, they feel like they're your friend right now.
I think back to, and I always hated this. I hated on American Idol when someone would get the note, you know, I just got to see more of you. You just got to put yourself more out there. But I think there is actually something to that. And getting out of the way of trying to create this alternative personality is never going to take you as far as if you can figure out how to be yourself in the middle of the craft that you're doing. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, once you start doing something that's not you, what's going to happen is that somewhere along the way, you're going to have to come out of this facade you created, and people going to see the real you. And you can't, when you have to manipulate who you are in order to gain people, then everything is going to be based on how much can you continue with that manipulation. And it takes away the fun of being in the actual room of stand-up. And that's one thing Steve Harvey had taught me. He said, man, make sure your live show is a live show, which means whatever's happening in the room, you have to acknowledge it and deal with it so people will know you in the same room they in. Otherwise, they might as well buy a DVD or listen to you on a CD if you ain't going to give them nothing real.
So do you end up, did you do some things to try to be more comfortable being who you are on stage, or was that easy for you right out of the gate?
I'm always going to be a little bit more exaggerated of who I am on stage, which gave me more room to, if it wasn't going well, I would shrink more to the real me instead of shrinking to a smaller version of the real me, which always gave me room to kind of fluctuate within still being me instead of doing something that I just would never do. I like to walk out on stage and like greet my audience the way I greet people that I know and people that I enjoy. Like you, with you to do, like when I see you, it's a joy that comes over me. So when I see you, I want you to see the joy that comes over me. So I'm going to be like, Whip, my dog, what's up, big dog? Man, good to see you. Well, you can't greet 1,000 people in the audience like that. So it's an exaggeration of that to where it's like, what's up, big dog? Nah, how y'all doing? Nah, that ain't good enough. How you doing? No, I say, how y'all doing? Because the room is exaggerated. So I have to be exaggerated to match the room, but it's still a version of me. So if I get uncomfortable for some reason and I begin to shrink on stage, I'm only shrinking to the real me instead of shrinking to a smaller version of me that's something you never want on stage smaller version of you.
So what are you reading the room along the way consciously?
I give the room about 10, I get a room about the first 15, 20% of the show. So however long the time is, the first 15-20% because I'm kind of programmed of like, here's what I need to do to bring the room to where I am. Because if I start out trying to read the room and match them, the room might be somewhere I don't want to be. So I'm like, I got to take y'all to where I am and bring y'all here. And then I can go from there to tell, you know, are y'all going to maintain here? Or this is going to be too much for y'all to keep up with. And then I need to go another direction. You know, it's like when you're trying to figure out your material, because there's a reality of the audience of like, okay, it is all women in here. You know what I'm not going to talk about? Playing college football. But I had that on my list. So let me get out of this. Or it's a room and it's like, man, they're all super young. So if I'm going to say something, making a reference to not a King James version, but a Rick James version, right, they might not know who Rick James is. So maybe I don't go that direction. So that's when the reading of the room, as far as kind of like, well, this makes sense with what's going on in here. Or maybe I'm talking about something that I only plan to do one or two jokes about, but they responded so great. I'm like, oh, let me dig in the crates and grab. Like, I got diabetes. So I have up to 15 minutes on diabetes. I might say, well, this look like a crowd might not really be laughing at diabetes. So I'm just going to do my 1A, what, 1 and 1A.
I'm just trying to figure out what does a crowd that looks like they wouldn't like diabetes jokes look like?
A nice, okay, healthy crowd. A nice old kale eating audience. Oh, celery stick, gluten free. Okay. I'm like, oh, so ain't nobody here out of shape. Ain't nobody got a bad diet, just me. Okay, all right, okay.
All right, but then you know that you've got something that they've responded to, and then you have the ability to shift gears. But what about if it's not just, yes, like the demographics? Because that's what you're talking about. You know, it's gender-based or age or whatever you're looking at for that. What if it's just the feel of the room? If it's sometimes it's just kind of the layout of the room seems like it'll have an impact on how the crowd responds without you working as hard. You know, just it's a hot room, and sometimes it's not a hot room. It's a cold place. And then how do you adjust for that kind of environment?
So, you know, you have jokes that have different kind of pacing to it. Got not necessarily a different cadence, but a different pace. So you like, oh man, they want they jokes. Like this room is responding better to things that are closer to one-liners.
Okay.
So now let me think of jokes that don't have as long of a setup. Let me try to get the stuff that may be a little bit quicker, because they real kind of pop, pop, pop. And then you'll be in a room and you like, you know what? They like the stories. Like, they like to hear, no, how did you get from that to this? And then you like, oh, you know what? I can kind of grab some of my stories from high school or grab some of my stories from college, because they really are kind of sit back and they just really enjoying you. They're not really a ha ha, oh, ha ha. They're more like, oh, that was great. Oh, that was funny. It's like, so y'all gonna let me take my time a little bit and give me the same response as the audience last night that was like, you better not ever slow down on us or we gonna start booing. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. I got you. And so for me, that's where it's the first 15-20% of the show, because I have jokes that are in both, in that first kind of scripted of the run I'm gonna do. And I'm like, okay, so when I was going pop, 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 y'all kind of wasn't with that as much. Y'all was like, I don't want to do that all night. You up there for an hour. I don't want to just go pop, pop, pop. I want you to tell me something about you. When you started talking about your son, or you started talking about your relationship with your mom, I was really into that more so than when you was complaining about being single, or you was talking about how you don't want your car stole or something. And that's the reading that's going on in that first 15-20% of like, okay, I'm seeing what y'all responding to as a group. And now I'm going to go more down that lane than not.
So you're crafting a first set, and are you then saying, I'm going to put in some rapid fire one-liner types. I'm going to put a couple stories out there. And based on how that goes, I'll go either to the left or to the right based on just response.
Yes. Like you'll find yourself, like if I'm doing 15 minutes, and I know the first 5 minutes I got, this is the rapid fire, pow, 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 pow. And then the next five can be like, it might not be pow, pow, but it's, you know, it's still funny. And then I'm going to close like this, which is cool. And then you do that first 2 minutes and they on top of everything you say, like stuff that wasn't even supposed to be funny. It was just kind of a setup or a premise. Mm-hmm. You immediately go in your head of like, oh, I can't do that joke that ain't got as much fire as this. I can't do this joke and ain't got as much fire. And you start just eliminating jokes that you like, that's going to take too long to get to the first laugh. This audience is like, we want it right now. And so that's part of the, the internal dialogue. Like one night I was at the Ice House in Pasadena. And I was in the side room. This was at least over 10 years ago. And Joe Coy was in the main room. Now, Joe Coy is an Asian comic, Filipino comic, big crowd, big fan base, Netflix specials. Well, Joe Coy came off stage early. So the owner of the Ice House came over to the other room and said, I need a comic to go do 10 minutes to finish out this show because Joe Coy came off early. And they still dropping tabs. I need somebody to do this 10 minutes. Well, all the comics, I was on stage. They recommended me. They was like, oh, Bone should do it. Send Bone. I was on stage. So the owner was like, cool. He killing on stage. Okay, let's bring him over. And so when I walk out, they like, hey, man, you got to come over here. And I was like, I'm not finna follow Joe Coy in his audience. They're like, yeah, you are.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was on stage, I was immediately cutting the fat off of each joke that I wanted to do because I'm like, they're not going to let me say stuff that don't matter. And my comedic mind immediately went to just cut. Don't say that. You don't need to say that to get to this punch. You don't need to say that to get to this punch. And afterwards, we were at Denny's and all the comics was like, man, you know, that's the new way you got to do all them jokes. Like, we've heard it and we like it, but dude, what you did over there. And I was like, nah, when I get back over here, I'm putting all them words back in. I need you to know that I had a pinstripe suit on. That was relevant to me. They're like, it wasn't relevant to the joke. I'm like, yes, it is.
Well, there is kind of an art of knowing which words are important, but you're kind of making the point that the choice of words is something that you should adjust to your audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You'll realize that sometimes audience can't make the leap, and you know you got to have it in there to help them connect what you're saying. And then sometimes you like, nah, they leaping with me. They'll make the jump. I don't have to explain to them that I was 8. They get it, that I must have been under 12 in order for this to be funny. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, huh, maybe that's some fat that's not needed. And then you'll go do it 3 more times and you like, you got to tell them you 8, man. If you don't tell them you 8 years old, they don't know why that's relevant. They trying to figure out why your big grown behind is mad because your mama gave you Cheerios instead of Frosted Flakes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So that is a type of listening that you're doing. I mean, it can be that you're hearing the laugh and the laugh is telling you what the audience is into, but it's not always, you know, the volume of the laughter. You're getting a vibe off of the audience and letting that take you where you want to go. If it's a question of, well, let's give you the example of you followed somebody who didn't do well. You know, they've kind of tanked on stage and you've got a room that is in kind of the negative position and you got to win them back or get them at least back to even or get them to where you want them to be. Are there things that you do that are different than what you just shared in that setting?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because if they think you are not in the room, meaning you didn't see the same thing they saw, they don't trust you. So you have to do something to acknowledge what happened. Now, depending on who you are as a person, it's going to decide which angle you go at. You know, a lot of comics, they'll just throw that comic under the bus And you just know that's just part of the course. It's like, hey, man, nothing personal, but if I don't throw you up under the bus, the audience is about to eat me up.
Yeah.
Now, me personally, I want to do my best to not throw that comic up under the bus. So I would be more inclined to acknowledge the moment in the room versus acknowledging the comic itself. You know, it would be more of me coming up to the room like, well, let's all just pretend like what happened didn't happen.
That's not throwing the comic under the bus.
Everybody done had a day.
You say what? That's not throwing the comic under the bus. It sounds like it to me.
Because to me, throwing the comic up under the bus is to just say that comic was bad. He was so not funny. Oh, that was the worst thing ever happened in life. It's like, okay, man, come on. That's gonna get a laugh, but don't do that. Let's pretend like what just happened didn't happen, and then you take it somewhere else. It's like that's enough to acknowledge what happened.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, well, let's take it somewhere else. It's like, okay, so now I gotta figure out how to do something that was gonna open up, because clearly what I wrote down, I hadn't wrote that down based on this happening. You know how you ever went to the store and you was going to buy something, you had $5 because you know it was on sale for $4.99, and you get there and it's actually $10, and then you trying to figure out what you going to do with the $5 you had? Mm-hmm. Something like that. It's like, let me give you an analogy that doesn't necessarily pinpoint the comic, but just give you a scenario that's still taking you away from that particular comic. But the situation is the situation.
Yeah. I want to get back to one of the other things that you brought up. And when you talked about the gene, that some people have a gene for stand-up, or whether it's basketball or whatever. And I think what you're saying is that there's some people who just are able to get to a different level based on that specific attribute or whatever. But what about the folks who may not have, you know, the Michael Jordan gene when it comes to basketball? With respect to comedy, are there some people who just, do you think, can't get to a pro level? Or is this something that if you work at it, you can get there?
I mean, there's always going to be, I don't know if you remember this guy's name, Bill Bates. He used to play with the Dallas Cowboys back in the day.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a Bill Bates. Bill Bates was not good enough just as an athlete to play in the NFL, but he worked so hard that he got himself to NFL level. If you take 10 Bill Bates out of high school, you might go 0 for 10. If you take 10 Michael Jordans out of high school, three of them without even working, still going to play in the NBA. So when you got a Michael Jordan who has the gene plus the work ethic, you become Michael Jordan. Bill Bates, it's not a lot of guys that's not that athletic that's willing to work that hard to make it to the NFL. So, yes, there's comics that they don't have that, but they're willing to work that hard to get good enough to have a legitimate career, because Bill Bates had a legitimate career in the NFL.
But Bill Bates wasn't also 5'1" and 130 pounds, right?
Right. So 5'1", 130 pounds, I don't care how much work you put in it, you're not physically going to be able to keep up with the very minimum of an NFL. Yeah. So you take somebody that does not, they cannot see comedy. They don't understand why something is funny. It's like, I don't care how much work you do, at some point, like the rule of threes, that has to make sense to you. Even if you ain't going to be one that's stuck with it, you know, you're like, I ain't gonna do it. That's fine, but you got to understand the rule of threes. You got to understand A, B, 3, and 1, 2, C. Like, that just has to make sense to you. If it doesn't make sense to you, I don't know how you're going to be able to come up with enough funny to actually have a career in this.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, that's being 5'1". Like, I don't understand about the rule of threes. You don't understand that? No. Well, then you're going to always have trouble writing, Because trust me, at some point, you're going to have to do a joke where the rule of threes applies.
Yeah. In improv, there's the aspect of listening and being present and all of that aspect. And that sometimes will take you a fair amount of the way. And if you work hard at that, you probably can, quote unquote, get on the field. But you still have to have the ability to listen and be present. I mean, there's a different skill set that if you can work on it, you can get there. But I don't know. It is to me, you see some people who continue to work at it and they don't seem to have that switch flip. And I'm talking more about stand-ups, I guess, than I maybe see with improvisers. But there's only so many improvisers relative to stand-up, too. So,
and that's where I'm saying I don't think they understand how humor and comedy work enough on their own to match the worth ethic that they putting into it to make it happen. Like I asked my coach one time in high school, and we as my basketball coach, I'm like, everything is a mental error. Like if you don't concentrate at the free throw line, if you don't shoot a layup with your left hand on the left side when you see it can be blocked, if you double dribble, all these things are mental errors. He was like, yeah. I said, well, what is a physical error? He said, you trying to guard Shaq. That's a physical error. And I was like, wow, okay. And so that's where I put, it's almost like it's a physical, like you being a person 5'1", 130 pounds, it's a physical error that you cannot play in the NFL. Because you physically are incapable. It's nothing against you. It's just 5'1", 130. There is nothing you can do and win. Mm-hmm. That unless you run in a 4'1". Mm-hmm. But chances are you're not running a 4'1". Right. So The way I apply that to comedy is if you don't understand how a sense of humor work, no matter how much work you do, you can't make it happen because there's nothing you can do to make people laugh because you don't understand what you need to be doing to make them laugh in the first place. Now, there's guys I know, they're not funny guys. Like, I hang out with them outside of comedy. They're not funny guys, but they know how to write a monologue. Mm-hmm. They know how the rule of threes work. They know how exaggeration work. They know how misdirection work. They just not good at it. But if they sit down, they can give you 10 minutes of things that people will laugh at. Long as they can stay in that 10 minutes, they good. The minute something happens and they not in that 10, they're going to be exposed. Yeah. So they're not good with hecklers. They're not good with anything happening in the room. And they never going to be good with any kind of improv.
Do you think that's because in part they can't be in the moment because it has to be written down and crafted?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because when they're in the moment, they don't have any type of sense of humor to help them get out of the moment. Mm-hmm. Like I had Zach Levi, the guy who plays Shazam. I had him host a show for me in L.A. He had never did stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And Kerry Pomeroli was on the show, Sherry Shepherd. Mm-hmm. And Kerry kept asking me, why are you letting him host this show? This is such a big show. And he ain't did stand-up. I said, because I know he knows how to be funny. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what did that got to do with stand-up? I'm like, if you know how to be funny, I just need you to be funny in the moment.
Yeah.
Like, being funny is so much bigger than just having a monologue that somebody gave you to say. Because if Zach starts not getting laughs, he knows what to do to get laughs. Versus somebody, they got a great 10 minutes, but I'm like, but they're not funny. If something happens with that 10 minutes and they have to depend on them, everybody in trouble.
We're coming up on time a little bit, but I want to ask you, what do you like best about stand-up?
Now, it's funny. I do a lot of festivals with a lot of the music groups. And the one thing that I notice on the music groups, they always got a set list because it's a band. So they know exactly what 10 songs they're going to sing and when what order. Mm-hmm. And you really can't change nothing up, even if you see something happen in the room because, hey, we got to do these songs on the set list. I can make a set list, but I can change up in a heartbeat. There is nobody that I have to answer to about doing joke 5 first if I decide that it makes sense to do joke five first. I don't have to stick to anything that I had already agreed upon in my mind that I was going to do before the show started. So I have such this freedom to do whatever makes sense at that time in my show to be funny. So I don't get thrown when people talk to me, because if that's part of what's going on that's funny, then that's part of what's going on is funny. I have the luxury of it's just me, and I get to control the room. So I'm the ringleader of having a good time. So those two kind of go hand in hand together, is that I get to switch up whatever I want to, and it's just me. It's just me to answer to. And I mean, making people laugh is always a great thing. I ain't never heard nobody ever be mad about somebody that made them laugh. I ain't never had nobody after the show, if you ever make me laugh like that again, I'm gonna kill you, Bone. That ain't never happened.
Yeah.
Never that.
What do you like least about stand-up comedy?
That there's gonna be some points to where you're gonna be controlled by the room more than yourself. And you just kind of got to deal with, this is just what the room is. You know, if a certain type of clientele came to this show that you happen to be on, and there's some things that you want to talk about, but you know you can't because the clientele that's in the room right now, that ain't really what they finna go for. And it's like, yeah, I wanted to say this, but this just wasn't the room for it. And it's like, just got to kind of live with it, because that's the good, that's the ups and the downs of stand-up.
Do you have something specific in mind on that?
I mean, like, if it's a room that don't know football, and I'm like, I want to talk about playing college football. If it's a room that if something has a, okay, and maybe not so much as, you know, they don't want to hear it, or maybe they don't understand it. Yeah. Like, you know, I'll do some jokes in a black church that I won't do in a white church, simply because it's such a cultural thing. Like, I have a joke about making a plate to go at a family function.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the black culture, you can get in a lot of trouble making a plate to go. You take too much food, somebody gonna tap you on the shoulder and be like, you need to put some of that food back. You're not gonna take all that food home. And it's a thing that we know. And so when I do the joke about it, calling it out, it is a big belly laugh when I'm at a black function, black environment, because it's like, oh, he calling out about making a plate to go. That's funny. You know, there's a line that say, we will call you out. Excuse me, what you think you doing? I'm making me a plate for my baby daddy. Your baby daddy needs to start coming to eat functions if they want something to eat. That's a call out. It works. Every time I do that joke and it's an all white audience, the whole audience is looking at me like, I don't get it. And you know why? Because every time I go to a white function, they help me make a plate to go. They're like, Bo, will you please take all this food home? I'm like, are you sure? Because this going to last me about 4 days, and that's a good thing in my life. Please, please. And so that something like that, because I really like to joke, but I'm like, it's not about I like to joke. It's about a joke that's for the audience that they can respond to and like it as much as you.
Gotcha. Well, I really appreciate this time, Bone. Thank you for giving a little different angle on the world of comedy. There's a lot to learn from the different disciplines, if that's the right word for comedy. I appreciate what you do. I appreciate the way you do interact with audiences. I think it's something to see, so people should look you up, and hopefully we get a chance to talk again sometime real soon.
Man, thank you, man, and I appreciate and love to be able to watch what y'all do, man. Y'all on another level to me, man, because I can't do it.
I've seen Bone live a number of times, and I've seen the crowd's comfort level with him on stage. It's really a fascinating thing, but it's also a testament to his approach to the audience. He's there for them, and he wants everyone to have a good time, and he structures what he does to accomplish that. That's not always a performer's mindset, but every performer should consider what impact that kind of a mindset might have on their work and a crowd's responsiveness. Another thing that stuck with me after my conversation with Bone was the notion of starting out as a bit of an exaggerated version of yourself in your act, and that gives you room to shrink backwards towards yourself without having to shrink back to being less of yourself. I think there's a ton of wisdom in that approach, because once the audience thinks you're holding back, they won't be with you as much, or maybe even at all. How to work that out may need to be a follow-up topic because there are layers to that that would take a more focused unpacking. I'll have links to Bone Sight and some of his projects on the episode page at improvcomedyconnection.com and look for him when he's performing at a comedy club or other venue in your area. If this has been useful to you, please spread the word, rate, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you think it could be more useful or you got a great idea for a topic or a guest, please let me know. I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. I've really enjoyed being your host again on this episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. My name is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fishsticks Comedy. You can check us out at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And if you're up for playing someone mediocre at 2K, my Xbox profile is Shill Smooth, so hit me up if you want to win a game by 15 or better. You'll probably feel that much better about yourself, and I'll feel good about that. Thanks for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.